From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories, personal documentaries, and what I call radio movies, kind of a cinematic audio story. And this episode is a good example. It's a new piece from longtime Unfictional contributor Eric Allen. And listening to him is a kind of hypnotic trip that weaves through history and memory and may not go where you're expecting. Eric Allen once spent 10 weeks alone in a Depression-era cabin that was scheduled to be demolished. And something happened to him in there. But the only proof is in the pages of a small, blue, spiral-bound notebook. From KCRW, it's Unfictional, a story called The Cabin Notebook.
I don't know why I'm telling you this. It's the story of one of my biggest adult mistakes, if not the biggest mistake. And it was supposed to solve everything. I was 21, a sophomore in college, and I was failing. And this was a college without grades, by the way. Prescott College was a granola, hippy-dippy, choose-your-own-adventure type of liberal arts school. It still is, I bet. But after obsessively filling up spiral-bound notebooks with my poetry for a few years, I chose Prescott College to be a writer. They had no writing department to speak of, but Prescott is where my grandparents lived. And by the end of my first year, I was really struggling, but the only advice my counselor gave me was that college wasn't for everybody, which might have been true, but I needed some help. I was still mad about that. So, Sam Henry, you know, fuck you. But I had a plan, because I'd been here before. My junior year of high school, I was in danger of flunking out, and my plan was to change high schools. That was my big plan for my senior year, change high schools. My counselor, thankfully, knew that you can't outrun yourself. You know, I'd take my problems with me in my backpack. And she did me a huge, life-changing favor. She got me into an honors internship program. Like, you had to have like a 3.5 GPA, and I was gonna fail. I did not have that. And like, if you wanted to learn robotics, they'd get you into NASA. If you fancied yourself president someday, they'd get you with the local congressman's office. Whatever your interest was. So they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. Before I tell you my answer, man, in my defense, it was the late 80s, and MTV was huge. So they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a music video director. They didn't know what to do with that. So they got me into a basic cable television channel nearby. And the internship was full time. I went to work, not to school. And I rocked it. I ran studio camera. I ran Chiron. I handled audio on remote shoots. I did setup and breakdown. I corded the mic cables properly. I erased stacks of tape. I loved it, and I got an A. And this was seven periods worth of A. This was a whole semester, so I made the dean's list. And it was just barely by a feather enough to get me a diploma, just barely. So now that I was in college, I had to design my own semester and get myself out of that hole again. So this was my plan. I found out that the school had access to a cabin in the mountains of southern Arizona, and it was open in the winter because it was cold as shit up there and nobody wanted to stay there then. But that's when it was open and I was ready. I was going to go up there by myself for 10 weeks. Had no electricity, had one wood stove, no phone, no toilet. There's an outhouse for it. This is before cell phones. I was going to be completely isolated for 10 weeks. And my plan was to go up there, and in that 10-week period, I was going to write a novel. Now, I didn't have an outline of a novel, an idea of a novel, or I've never written part. part of a novel or even a decent short story. There's a notebook. The notebook from that period. I still keep it. It's been with me ever since. And I never read through it, though. I keep it. It's an object. It's proof. Because something happened there in the cabin. And I'm going to tell you. But it's not in the notebook. But I need to read through this notebook to get us there. It's just a 200-sheet college rule, five-subject, spiral-bound notebook. The cover is worn. It's obliterated, decades old, sky blue. The first page says, shakedown, distribute. Shakedown, distribute on fruit trees, paper. Can behind chimney, open side flue. Oh, there are notes. Shakedown, distribute on fruit trees, paper. Can behind chimney. Open side flue, shut after catch. Right side flue lever after 30 minutes. So I got to the cabin and I started to sit there. I started to worry. I started to fret. It started to rain. And the wood I had brought up with me was too wide for the wood stove. So I had to saw the wood in half and then chop it. And on the next page it says, now listen, all the life that I was waiting to put into words has clogged up into building a fire, not knowing exactly how to take care of myself here, wondering what I'm going to do for 10 weeks. I'm from the suburbs. And before this, I had never even been camping. So when I had a few hundred dollars to buy supplies for 10 weeks, I asked two friends, two women at school, and they each brought a friend. So I brought four women with me to the grocery store to help me shop for the cabin. And the five of us went to the grocery store and started filling up a shopping cart. I didn't really have a plan, and I didn't know what I was walking into. So I took everybody's advice, and I ended up with so many cans of green beans, and I fucking hate canned green beans, but there are so many cans of green beans. This page says, I came up here to escape, up to an old house, cold and falling apart except for the kitchen. This is an old man's house, and I'm 21. The kitchen is cradled with love and regret by a man who escapes here every weekend of the summer to harvest his prized garden. Mutant trees with four distinct fruits from one tree. I'm sure it's a beautiful thing, but it's winter now, and only the naked branches are here soaked with rain. The whole half-acre lot is a garden. And I'm quoting him here, working with the natural pattern of the forest. And the next minute he tells me of one spring where he had to have the hoses watering the trees for 48 hours straight, stealing spring water from the Depression-era spring box in the creek. In this part of the notebook, I'm like turning on my environment, specifically complaining about Richard Landis, who lived in the cabin for decades. He was an artist and weaver who created textiles that are in museum collections. But this was just a couple years before he stopped working there altogether. The winters had become too hard for him in the cabin. Although everyone, including me, called it the cabin, it was really a Depression-era house. Two small bedrooms, a dining room, a living room, and a kitchen. Now mostly stripped of furniture, and it hadn't been painted in decades because Richard had control of the physical structure of the house, but the land underneath was always federal land. So it was a frozen relic. And in the living room there was a couch and nothing else, and that's where his loom was for years. And there was a giant 4x6 old government map of Arizona, and a vine had grown in from outside to the crack at the bottom of the floor and twisted up around one of the sides of the map. And where an oven had been, or a stove had been decades before, the ceiling just had a hole in it, and there was a plastic bucket underneath the hole to catch the drops of rain. There's no date, but on this page it says, I want rhythm, I want to feel pulse, I want to guess the words before you say them. I loved her. And when I called her on the phone to tell her I was in town, she said, why? It's okay, she said. It's okay. There's no one here but me. I fill a lot of notebook pages thinking about women, especially Heather. The car is hers. I'm in the passenger seat with the window down halfway and the heater on full. It's the drive from Vegas to Los Angeles. Her car's a mess, and tapes, half packs of cigarette, and strange, cheap dime store toys block the speedometer. I guess she's into feeling how fast she's going instead of seeing it. The car's low on gas. I'm always afraid the engine will overheat or will coast to the shoulder of the road with her going, what the fuck is wrong? Or her just staring straight ahead, not reacting to the fact we're out of gas and just sitting there. But the car always works, and we never run out of gas, and we've driven together a lot. It's the only thing we can really do together. Thanksgiving, and I have to work in 12 hours. We have some junk food and warm Dr. Pepper in the back seat in case we get hungry, and all our tapes are at my feet. The wind's ripping into my face and stings the red secret flesh. I love that metaphor. Everything's a secret flesh. Morning. Dawn. She smokes a lot, but never in a pattern. See, this is, I'm trying to tell the story. We drove to Vegas. I was living in Hollywood, and she would visit me. She was living in Arizona. You know, she is the first person to broke my heart. She was going to school in Arizona, and she'd drive out to Los Angeles to visit, and over a Thanksgiving break, we went to Vegas, and I called my job from Vegas to tell them I'm sick. I was working at Tower Sunset, Tower Records, and that's a huge sales day. I'm 19. I was lucky to have the job. And they were basically like, if you don't show up, you're fired. We need you today. You can't call in sick. And Heather and I had just gotten a cheap motel to crash because we'd driven there through the night, and we couldn't stay awake any longer. But we turned around, went down to the desk and told them the motel was disgusting and we had to leave. There's no way we'd pay for it. And they thought we were trying to scam them by going up long enough to take a shower. We got our money back, but we didn't have any money. We needed all of it. And it's morning and we turn around and drive to Los Angeles. And I make it just in time for my shift. I've been in the car. You know, I hadn't slept. I'd been in the car over 10 hours. I looked like shit. I walked in and I did my shift, and they fired me soon after that. Every day I'd walk up the dirt road. An elevation increase, so it was a bit of an exercise, but the benefit was after a couple switchbacks, I'd be up high enough to see out. Off the mountain and down the canyon, and you could see the weather come in. And that's all I got. That was what I did every day. That That was the space of my living. The rest was just keeping warm and hating the food I brought and shitting in the outhouse. And then the notebook says, I've been avoiding this for probably 5 days. So this notebook just has 5 day holes in it. When I was in third grade, I distinctly remember a science lesson on fossils, what they were, and that they were trapped in the rocks. Okay, I went home and tested that theory. We had a creek nearby, so I lit off for the creek, and I sat there at the edge of the creek getting rocks, you know, the size of softballs, rocks that could fit in my tiny hand, and I was breaking them in half, breaking up rocks, looking for fossils. And soon enough, I cracked a rock open. Perfectly, it opened, and on one side was the relief of the shell, and the other side was the impression of the shell. Perfect, half, split, tiny, shell, fossil. Okay, I thought, I'll believe you, but Mr. Science Teacher, look at that. And now, as an adult, if I went out to the creek and busted a rock for years and thousands, I probably wouldn't find a fossil. But it's that raw youth question. Okay, fossils come from rocks? We'll go find a fossil. That's, I think, as simple as my thinking was. Here, I'd go up to the cabin and I'd find a novel. All I needed was some time and a notebook. It's in cursive and starts normal size and then gets big, so there's only 3 words at a time, like an inch high. But it starts out, it says, wandering, wandering, I see a field. Dream spring field, empty green, and something, 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 scribble, scribble, F-U-U-C-K, fuck this. In classes, a few times during this period, a class would come up and use the space and everyone would just crash out on the floor and, you know, camp in the cabin. So I'd go about 2 weeks before I'd see anybody. If you're talking about a resupply or a visit from a class, 2 weeks was the longest I ever went not talking to anybody, not seeing anybody. You know, no phone, no television, no radio. Literally nobody. There, once a day a car would go down the dirt road maybe, but I would never see the person inside. Although I would stop and listen. And a woman's studies class was due to visit, so there's going to be 12 college-age women visiting me. And I have not been lonelier in my life. Or more incapable of sustaining relationships. So the thought of 12 women coming up to the space that I had just spent weeks freaking out alone in just pinned me to the bed. And I had to think of something. I had to solve this problem. And in the moment, the perfect solution appeared in my mind. All I had to do was forever forward stop talking. If I said nothing, if I never said another word, I would be institutionalized and solved. It was so fucking obvious. And when I let go and finally committed to that solution, something slipped or snapped or opened. I was flooded with the feeling of a field, of like a magnetic field, not a prairie field, of being plugged into the full spectrum of light. Right then, I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. I have to stay here and stay in this place. And as soon as I did that, like a bubble popping, it was gone. And I realized immediately, grabbing onto that feeling, grabbing onto that vision, popped it like a bubble, and it was gone. But that millisecond glimpse was enough to register and stop me from never speaking again. It was a very tiny moment of time that was very long in my memory. The woman's studies course came the next day. They flooded through my space, and I took a corner of the room, and I could barely say anything, and I felt like an idiot. But I was filled with the relaxing feeling of people being around me, even as all elbows and mute as I felt. I was still part of this class that came up and had to cook and meet together. And better still, they found out how low my supplies were, and one of the women agreed to drive the van down to Globe to help me resupply. I mean, it was 12 miles to the pavement, and I don't remember how long to Globe, but it was a long time. And I was so relaxed and relieved at being in the passenger seat of a van with the window rolled down, cash in my pocket, ready to go buy some supplies. I was relaxed enough to have a good time. I wish I could remember her name. I never hung out with her again, but we had the best time just shooting this shit, and we took forever. I bought a pack of Camel Unfiltered. I bought a six-pack of Negro Modelo, which I had never had before. And every time I have a Negro Modelo, I think about the feeling of drinking the first one, sitting on the porch of that cabin as it was filled with women, and I'm smoking on a cigarette, working through that first beer, and it ain't raining. So I guess that's the core of the cabin, being blasted with a vision I wasn't equipped to see or process. After everybody left and I'm sitting on the couch and it's the afternoon, and how do I process what happened to me? That's when I saw a book by Troyam Trungpa. It was on a bookshelf in the kitchen that had a few random books that were left behind by past guests and students, and the book had been there the whole time. It was called Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior, and it had this to say about meditation. Then, in meditation practice, as you sit with a good posture, you pay attention to your breath. When you breathe, you are utterly there, properly there. You go out with the out-breath, your breath dissolves. And then the in-breath happens naturally. Then you go out again. And then there will be an inevitable bing, a thought. At that point, you say thinking. You don't say it out loud. You say it mentally, thinking. And I sat on the ground, looking 6 feet down, ahead of me a bit, concentrating on none of it, and lasting about 10 minutes. And then I tried it again the next day. The pressure readjusted. The membranes readjusted. The pressure took hold again. And I never have been worried about losing my shit like that. And I've never been worried about going there again. And all of my plans were wrong. Everything I did up there was triggered by mistakes and poor planning And all of it focused me towards that one glimpse. And without all of those mistakes piled up, I wouldn't have gotten there. I've heard it became a trailhead because it was federal land. And as I guess after Richard stopped using it, it was torn down. So where the cabin was is now the parking lot for a trailhead. So that's it. That's there was never a novel, right? But what I learned was that I can be alone. So I went up there lonely and left knowing how to be alone, which helped me. A couple years ago when the world shut down and I felt like I was in the cabin again, I guess that's why I wanted to tell you this story.
The Cabin Notebook was written and produced by Eric Allen, with score and mix by me, Bob Carlson. If you like this program, please subscribe to the Unfictional Podcast for more unusual and heartfelt true audio stories. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends about the program if you liked it. Plus, you can hear 10 years' worth of stories from the Unfictional Archive at KCRW, and you can find all of Eric Allen's other stories there, too, which are highly recommended. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Anna Buss. KCRW's content director for culture is Anielle Zuberi-Fields. Episode graphics by Alex Cirilla. Theme music by Alex Weston, with music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. Please join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.